Greetings and welcome to another episode of Canadian History X. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can. Just go to patreon.com/CanadaEHX. Also, it's an incredibly windy day here, so I'm hoping not too much of the wind gets picked up by the microphone, but if it does, I do apologize. Now, we're looking at 1892 in Canada, and I'm doing things a bit differently. In previous year-by-year episodes, I would just start at the beginning of the year and go through the events, the births, and the deaths, all the way to the end of the year. This time, I'm separating things into categories of deaths, births, very important people who were born, very important people who died, and events. So, let's just get right down to it. Mary Pickford. So let's begin with our look at the year 1892, and that year has one huge birth. And I mean huge birth in the terms of this person became incredibly famous. On April 8th, Gladys Louise Smith would be born in Toronto. She's better known as Mary Pickford, and for a time she was one of the biggest stars in Hollywood. She was called the Queen of the Movies, and she was one of the earliest stars to be billed under her own name. And she was nicknamed, ironically, America's Sweetheart, even though she was Canadian. The family was involved in acting from an early age, and after Pickford's father left the family, her mother began to take in boarders to pay the bills. One boarder was a Mr. Murphy, who was a stage manager for the Cummings Stock Company, and he gave Pickford her first acting role. In the early 1900s, the family was touring the United States performing in small theater companies, and after 6 years of barely making ends meet, Pickford landed a supporting role in a 1907 Broadway play called The Warrens of Virginia. It was for this play that Gladys would become Mary Pickford. In 1909, she screen-tested for director D.W. Griffith for a role in Pippa Passes. Now, she didn't get the role, but she began to act in films on a regular basis. Pickford would say of her acting at the time, "I played scrub women and secretaries and women of all nationalities. I decided that if I could get into as many pictures as possible, I'd become known and there would be a demand for my work." In 1909 alone, she appeared in 51 films and got her first starring role in The Violin Maker. In 1914, she would appear in Hearts Adrift, which began to launch her into superstardom. And by 1916, only Charlie Chaplin was more popular than Pickford in the movie world. Throughout the 1910s and 1920s, it was believed that Pickford was the most famous woman in the world. One journalist said she was the best-known woman who has ever lived, the woman who has known to more people and loved by more people than any other woman there has been in all history. On June 24, 1916, she signed a contract that gave her full authority over production of the films she was in, and she was earning $10,000 per week, or $237,000 per week today. She also received compensation of half a film's profits with a guarantee of $1,040,000, which would be $18.5 million today. In 1919, she would found United Artists with D.W. Griffith, Charlie Chaplin, and Douglas Fairbanks. She would continue to be extremely popular through the 1920s, but with the advent of sound, her career declined as she underestimated the value of sound in movies. Nonetheless, she won an Academy Award for Best Actress in 1929 for her role in Coquette. She would retire from acting in 1933 after several film failures, and would perform on the stage occasionally before becoming vice president of United Artists in 1936. In 1955, she published her memoirs called Sunshine and Shadows, and she spent most of her life at her home called Pickfair Manor, an 18-acre estate she had bought with her then-husband Douglas Fairbanks in the 1920s. She would typically receive visitors in the 1960s, speaking to them by telephone from her bedroom. When she received an honorary Academy Award in 1976, the Academy TV crew recorded her thank you from her home in Pickfair. Throughout her life, she held and traveled with a British-Canadian passport, and she renewed it on a regular basis and never became an American citizen. In the last years of her life, she made arrangements with the Canadian Department of Citizenship to acquire Canadian citizenship, believing that she had lost it, because her wish was, in her words, to die as a Canadian. She would pass away on May 29, 1979 in Santa Monica. During her life and after her death, she would receive many awards and honors. She has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, several theaters and buildings are named for her, and there is a bust of her and a plaque at her birthplace in Toronto, which is now the site of the Hospital for Sick Children. The plaque was unveiled by her husband, Buddy Rogers, in 1973, and the bust was added in 1983. In 1999, she received a star on Canada's Walk of Fame, and in 2006, she was featured on a postage stamp from Canada Post. A Google Doodle on April 8, 2017 commemorated her 125th birthday, and in 2019, the Toronto International Film Festival began to award the Mary Pickford Award. In 1959, she spoke with CBC about her early life in Toronto.
I was born in Toronto, Canada, and so was my father and my mother.
Whereabouts in Toronto?
On University Avenue.
Have you seen it lately?
No, it's torn down now.
Because University Avenue is a big, wide thoroughfare of office blocks and hospitals and things.
Do you want me to tell you how I feel about it?
Please do.
Oh, I'm very sad about my old Toronto.
Yes?
Mm-hmm. You know, I used to ride down on my bicycle right from Yonge Street down to Queen.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to pedal at all. You know, there's quite a little hill there.
Yes, you wouldn't notice it today. Of course, nobody ever rides a bicycle down University Avenue.
Well, I did, you know. When I went back, even after that the trees had been taken down on the bicycle path, I told the newspaper people how I love my bicycle. And when I was photographed in front of the house where I was born, there stood a bicycle.
What was Toronto like in those days? I suppose it was quite quiet and provincial.
Well, we used to have, you know, horses, naturally. And I still bear a scar that on coming down University Avenue and turning west, I think, on Queen, I got right in front of a pair of horses. And I had to put the brakes on the best I knew how. And I gouged my ankle, and I still have the mark there. But I like it, you know.
What, the mark?
Yes.
Oh, it gives you something to reminisce.
Oh, yes. And you know, I think at least once a month I dream that I'm back again in Toronto. Up in Queen's Park, High Park.
Mm-hmm.
Up north on Yonge Street.
Political events. On July 2nd, Theodore Davey would take over as Premier of British Columbia. He was the brother of Alexander Davey, and unlike the two previous premiers, we'll get to that, he would not die in office. He would serve until March 2, 1895, and during that time was instrumental in approving the construction of the legislative buildings in Victoria instead of moving the capital to the mainland. On July 9th, Parliament would pass the Criminal Code 1892, which is the first unified criminal code in Canadian history, under the direction of the Minister of Justice. The Act was sponsored by Sir John Sparrow David Thompson and was based on the Stephen Code written by Sir James Fitzjames Stephen for a royal commission in 1879 in England. The new code would oust from Canadian criminal law any offence under an Act of the British Parliament unless the Act was applicable to Canada. It also stated that no juvenile under the age of 7 could be convicted, and those that were between the age of 7 and 13 could only be convicted if they were competent to know the nature and consequence of the conduct. On November 24th, Sir John Abbott would resign as Prime Minister of Canada. He became Prime Minister after the sudden death of John A. Macdonald, and Abbott had served from June 16, 1891 to November 24, 1892. In his short time as leader, he attempted to negotiate a new treaty with the United States, but failed to reach an agreement, and he would see 52 by-elections held, 42 of which were won by Conservatives, and his effectiveness as Prime Minister would slowly diminish. On December 5th, Sir John Sparrow David Thompson, the former Justice Minister, would become the Prime Minister. He too would serve for only a short time, but he was the first Roman Catholic to hold the position. He would serve until December 12, 1894, when he went on a trip to England and died from a heart attack at the age of only 49. This resulted in Canada seeing two of its past three prime ministers die in office. Thompson would actually be the last prime minister to die in office. While he would be prime minister for only a short period of time, he nearly negotiated the admittance of Newfoundland in Confederation, but in the end this failed, and it would not be until 1949 that Newfoundland joined Canada. On December 16th, Sir Louis-Olivier Tallien would become the Premier of Quebec once again. He had first served as Premier for 2 days from January 25th, 1887 to January 27th, 1887. But this year he took over when Boucher de Boucherville resigned. His second stint as Premier would see him serving until 1896, when he became the Postmaster General for the Federal Conservative Party. The Great Fire of 1892. On July 8th, the Great Fire of 1892 would destroy two-thirds of St. John's, Newfoundland. The worst disaster to ever hit St. John's, it would begin at 4:45 p.m. when a dropped pipe in the stable of Timothy O'Brien began the fire, but several things would happen that would cause the fire to begin to rage out of control. Reverend Moses Harvey, who saw the fire in its initial stages, stated that it was a bad day for a fire. On that day, a high wind was blowing from the northwest, and as the fire began to grow, as sparks flew onto the shingled roofs that had not seen rain for a month, quickly caused the buildings to go up in flames, sending more sparks into the air, setting more places on fire. On that same day, work was being done on the water mains, which caused water service to be interrupted or pressure to be down. Water service was established at 3 p.m. that day, but the water pressure could not push the water up to the higher sections of the city, where the fire had actually begun. Within 1 hour, it was realized that the fire could not be contained, and people began to put valuables and themselves into stone buildings, like the Anglican Cathedral of St. John the Baptist. The fire would soon spread to the building, destroying it completely. It would be described by W.J. Kent as such. With one fearful rush, the demonic fire seized upon the doomed cathedral, and sooner than tongue could tell, the immense edifice, a gem of Gothic architecture, a masterpiece of Sir Gilbert Scott, and the pride of every Newfoundlander, it was a seething mass of flame. With a crash heard even above the din of the elements, the roof fell in, and the result of the labors of offerings of thousands for many years vanished in a cloud of smoke and dust. The fire then spread to Water Street, the commercial center of the city. Reverend Harvey would say, "The beautiful shops, full of valuable goods, the stores behind, containing thousands of barrels of flour and provisions of all kinds, the fish stores, the wharves, which had cost immense sums to erect, disappeared one by one to the maw of the destroyer. The whole of Water Street, on both sides, was swept with the bosom of destruction." Throughout the night and into the morning, the fire raged through the city. By the next light, the city was a smoldering ruin. Kent would say, "A walk through the deserted streets demonstrated that the fire was even more complete than seemed possible at first. Of the wholly easterly section, scarcely a building remained." In total, the disaster resulted in $13 million in damages, or $375 million today. Less than half of those losses were covered by insurance, and huge amounts of money came in from England, the United States, and Canada to help the city. Over the next few years, most of the city would be rebuilt, and most of the present-day registered heritage structures in the city were built or rebuilt after 1892. The fire would also result in a complete reorganization of the fire department, and by the end of 1895, the city had 22 paid firefighters and 3 new fire stations throughout the city. Other notable births. On May 3rd, Jacob Viner is born in Montreal. He would earn his undergraduate degree from McGill University in 1914 and go on to Harvard to earn his PhD in economics. He would serve as a professor at the University of Chicago from 1916 to 1917 and from 1919 to 1946, while also teaching at Stanford and Yale. He would teach at Princeton from 1946 until his death in 1970. For a time, he was an advisor to the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, Jr., during the administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He is also considered to be the founder of the concept of nuclear deterrence. At the Conference of Atomic Energy Control in 1945, he stated that the atomic bomb was the cheapest way yet devised of killing human beings, and that atomic bombs will be peacekeeping in effect. On May 18th, John Croke would be born in Little Bay, Newfoundland. He would enlist with the Canadian Army in 1915 and serve in the 55th Battalion as a private. He would arrive as part of the 3rd Brigade on the Western Front and participated in several notable Canadian battles, including Vimy Ridge, Hill 70, and Passchendaele. On August 8, 1918, during the Battle of Amiens, the 13th Battalion was held up by machine gun posts at Hangard Wood. Croke would attack a machine gun post and take several prisoners. He had been shot in the arm, but he ignored instructions to get the wound treated, and he carried out another attack on a machine gun post and was wounded, fatally, in the attack. He would be recognized for his bravery with the Victoria Cross. In all, before he was killed, he captured 3 machine guns and bayoneted or captured the entire garrison of Germans. His Victoria Cross was the first to be awarded to a soldier born in Newfoundland. At Glace Bay, Nova Scotia, where he grew up, there is a school named for him, and currently his medals are on display at the Canadian War Museum. On August 2nd, Jack Warner would be born in London, Ontario. He would move with his family to Youngstown, Ohio in 1896, where his father established a shoe repair shop. It was there he began to sing at a local theater and perform in vaudeville. During this time, he began working with his brother Sam to show early films, including The Great Train Robbery. In 1910, the brothers pooled their resources and formed a film production company called Warner Brothers. Over the next decade and more, the brothers would build their film production company into a dominant force in Hollywood. They would procure the technology to make the first talking picture, The Jazz Singer, and Warner was known for his shrewd instincts and tough-mindedness. James Cagney would make 38 films with the Warner Brothers, cementing the studio as a major studio. Warner would continue to lead the company and be a force in the motion picture industry until 1973, when he retired due to his failing health. He would pass away on September 9, 1978, at the age of 86. In 2004, he was given a star on Canada's Walk of Fame. Today, he is considered to be the person who shaped Hollywood's golden age. This is a clip from the 1959 Academy Awards when Warner was being presented with a Lifetime Achievement Award.
I'm here to present the Irving Thalberg Award. As a former winner and the gentleman who runs 20th Century Fox, the company that produces oil, we are happy to introduce to you Mr. Buddy Adler, ladies and gentlemen. Thalberg Award is given only when the Academy Board of Governors decides there is a deserving recipient. It is given to the individual who has been responsible for the most consistent high quality of motion picture production for the current awards year and the 4 preceding years. It gives me great pleasure to announce that the board has voted the Thalberg Award to Mr. Jack L. Warner.
Irving Thalberg, whose memory this award honors, was a warm personal friend of mine throughout his entire career. I am most grateful to the Academy Board of Governors for this honor. It is one that I will always remember and cherish. I thank you very much.
On August 16th, Hal Foster would be born in Halifax. He would work as a staff artist for the Hudson's Bay Company in Winnipeg before riding his bicycle to Chicago in 1919 and studying at the Chicago Academy of Fine Arts. In 1929, he began to make the Tarzan comic strip, adapted from the novels of the same name. In 1937, he premiered Prince Valiant, which became a massive success and ran for 4,000 Sunday strips and appeared in more than 300 American newspapers at its height. It was so popular that the Duke of Windsor called it the greatest contribution to English literature in the past 100 years. Foster would continue to draw the strip until 1971, and the strip runs to this day under other artists. At the age of 73, he was elected to membership in the Royal Society of Arts, a rare honor given to someone living in the United States. His work would influence many comic artists, including Jack Kirby and Bob Kane, and he would pass away in 1982. In 1996, he was inducted into the Will Eisner Award Hall of Fame, and in 2005, was inducted into the Joe Shuster Canadian Comic Hall of Fame. On the date of his death, the CBC played clips from an interview they did with Foster 2 years previous.
He is a Canadian. He grew up in Halifax and then moved to Winnipeg with his family when he was about 15. They were very poor. He was very uneducated. And the only thing, really, that he could do is draw. So he made a career of that. What we have here is a little clip, and he's remembering Halifax Harbor around the turn of the century.
So many kids in school are better than I was at learning. I suppose that's why I went to the outdoors. Mm. Halifax Harbor was such a romantic place. Gosh, on a summer day, you'd look up the harbor, and the harbor was just covered with white canvas. And square riggers, and schooners, and dirty little coasting ships. And then that hauls down the shore. There's so many interesting things, life on the shore, the tides, and the wind, it always meant something. Always meant something to me. I could tell every ship, every schooner, every coaster that came to Halifax, I could tell just where it came from by the smell. Jamaica would come in with a delicious smell of rum mixed with bilge water, and other boats would come in, for instance, smell of onions. That came from Bermuda. And of course the fishing boats came in. Oh, what beautiful boats those were. Two-masted schooners. One of them was the Blue Nose. And I saw her 50 years later, mast cut down, box on the back where you had the controlled diesel engine. Like seeing an old actress in a wheelchair. And I went back to Halifax 50 years after I left it. And not a ship on the harbor, not a boat, not even a rowboat. One ship, a great big freighter. And I looked at this immense thing, and it could carry more goods than all these little ships in the harbor could do in a week. All the romance was gone, but here was this great, big, efficient.
On September 24th, Adelard Gabou would be born in Quebec. He would be elected to the Quebec legislature in 1926 and serve until 1936, and then again from 1939 to 1948. During his first term in the legislature, he would serve as the Minister of Agriculture. He would go on to serve twice as Premier of Quebec. The first term was from July 11, 1936 to August 28, 1936, after he took over as Liberal leader and became Premier, losing in the election in August. He would make his political comeback in 1939, becoming the Premier on November 8th of that year, and serving until August 30, 1944. As Premier of the province, he would enact the right for women to vote in 1940, despite resistance from the Catholic Church, and he would establish the Civil Service Commission in 1943. He also required school attendance until the age of 14, and he introduced free primary school education, while also nationalizing the Montreal Light, Heat, and Power Company into Hydro-Quebec. He also adopted a labor code for the province. He would pass away on September 18, 1956 in Montreal, and today is a member of the Canadian Agricultural Hall of Fame and the Agricultural Hall of Fame of Quebec. On October 25th, Nell Shipman would be born in Victoria. She would grow up in a middle-class family, and the family would move to Seattle in 1904, at which point she joined a theater company and traveled for a few years performing. She would marry Ernest Shipman in 1910, and the couple would move to Hollywood, and Nell would sell the rights to her novel, Under the Crescent Moon, to Universal Studios. Along with writing, she also began working in movies, starting two independent producing companies. And in 1919, she would release the most successful silent film in Canadian history, Back to God's Country. Not only working as a screenwriter and producer, she also acted in several films from 1915 to 1918, with a few more roles in the 1920s. Today, she is considered to be the first lady of Canadian cinema. Noted for her passion for animal rights, she would develop her own zoo, which would contain over 200 animals at one point, and she would pass away on January 23, 1970, at the age of 77. Notable deaths. On March 7th, Andrew Wetmore passed away at the age of 71. He was born on August 16, 1820, and would enter politics in 1865, with his election to the New Brunswick Colonial Legislature as an anti-Confederate. When he wasn't appointed as an Attorney General for the party, his opposition to Confederation declined quickly, and he crossed the floor to join the Confederation Party, which became the government in 1866. When New Brunswick joined Canada in 1867, many prominent New Brunswick politicians took roles in the House of Commons, allowing Wetmore to assume leadership of the party, becoming the first premier of New Brunswick in 1867. He would serve until May 25, 1870. Under his premiership, he would provide financial extensions to rail lines in the province, incorporate the College of St. Joseph, and would grant full property rights to all married women living apart from, or had been deserted by, husbands. On April 6th, John Austell would pass away in Montreal. He was born on August 7, 1813 in London, and would come to Canada in 1834 to apprentice under André Trudeau in Montreal in the French methods of surveying. He would become an architect and designed many important buildings in early Montreal, including the McGill University Arts Building, the High School of Montreal, and the Grand Seminaire de Montreal. In 1859, he left architecture and worked in his lumber business that he had started in 1852. In 1856, he employed 75 people in a factory that covered 5 acres. On May 24th, Sir Alexander Campbell would pass away in Toronto at the age of 70. Born on March 9, 1822 in England, he came to Canada when he was a baby with his father. He would study law and become a partner in the law office of John A. Macdonald. In 1858, he was elected to the Legislative Council, serving until 1867. He would attend the Charlottetown Conference and the Quebec City Conference, and is considered a father of Confederation. In 1867, he would be appointed to the Senate of Canada, serving until 1887. That year, he became the 6th Lieutenant Governor of Ontario, serving from 1887 until his death. On June 29th, something that was oddly common during the early years of British Columbia happened. John Robson would pass away in office as Premier of the province. He got his finger caught in the door of a carriage while in England, and would contract blood poisoning and die in London. Serving as the 9th Premier of British Columbia from August 2, 1889 to June 29, 1892, he would actually take over from Alexander Davy, who himself had died in office as well. During his tenure as Premier, he would enable homesteading, get a dry dock constructed near Victoria, and in 1886, before he was Premier, he was the one who had the legislature name the new community of Vancouver, in honor of the explorer who had visited the area the previous century. On August 30th, Frederick Gisborne died at the age of 68. He was born on March 8, 1824 in England, and came to Canada in 1845 after 3 years traveling around the world. He became an expert electrician, and he was appointed the superintendent of the lines of Nova Scotia at Halifax. He would also lay down the first deep-sea cable in North American waters between Prince Edward Island and New Brunswick in 1852. 1 year later, he was appointed the chief engineer of the New York, Newfoundland, and London Telegraph Company. The company would lay the first deep-sea telegraph cable between Europe and North America. In 1879, he was made the superintendent of the Canadian Government Telegraph Service, a position he held until his death. On September 12th, Marc Amamble Girard would die at the age of 70. He was born on April 25, 1822, in Lower Canada, and would find his way out to Manitoba after he was sent there during the Red River Resistance in 1870. After Manitoba became a province, he was elected to the Legislative Assembly, serving until 1883. During that time, he would serve as the second Premier of Manitoba, first from December 14, 1871, to March 14, 1872, and then again from July 8, 1874, to December 2, 1874. While serving the legislature, he would be appointed to the Senate of Canada, serving from December 13, 1871 until his death. On December 14th, Adams George Archibald would pass away at the age of 78. Born in Nova Scotia on May 3, 1814, he would become a Father of Confederation for his support of Confederation. He would be elected to the House of Commons from 1869 to 1870 and again from 1888 to 1891. In that gap, he became the first Lieutenant Governor of the Northwest Territories and the first Lieutenant Governor of Manitoba, serving in both positions simultaneously from May 20, 1870 to December 2, 1872. He then served as the fourth Lieutenant Governor of Nova Scotia from 1873 to 1883. Alexander Mackenzie. There was a very notable death in 1892. Alexander Mackenzie, the second Prime Minister of Canada, would pass away at the age of 70. He had been born in Scotland on January 28, 1822, and after leaving school at the age of 13, he trained as a stonemason and immigrated to Canada when he was 19, settling in what would be Ontario. He had become interested in politics, and in 1861, he was elected to the Legislative Assembly of the Province of Canada. A supporter of Canadian Confederation, he would be elected to the House of Commons in 1867, and in 1873, became the leader of the Liberal Party and the leader of the official opposition. A few months later, after MacDonald and his party were hit with the Pacific Scandal, Mackenzie and his Liberals would win a majority government in 1874, thereby making him Prime Minister. Due to his humble background and democratic tendencies, he was very popular with the public. His democratic ideals were shown when he refused the offer of a knighthood 3 times, something other prime ministers, including those who only served for a few months, gladly took advantage of. Another story of his working-class background comes from when he was touring Fort Henry as prime minister. He asked a soldier with him if he knew how thick the wall was. The soldier did not know, and Mackenzie stated, "I do. It is 5 feet 10 inches. I know, because I built it myself." As Prime Minister, he would establish the Supreme Court of Canada and the Royal Military College. He would establish the District of Keewatin in future Manitoba, but he would make little progress in getting the Transcontinental Railway built. In 1878, his government suffered a terrible defeat as MacDonald and his government rose back to prominence. He would continue to serve as leader of the party and the opposition until 1880, and would remain a member of the House of Commons until 1892, when he died following a stroke. In a study of the first 20 prime ministers of Canada, Mackenzie ranked 11th. Several places are named for Mackenzie as well, including the Mackenzie Mountain Range, Mount Mackenzie, several buildings, schools, and the Mackenzie Building at the Royal Military College of Canada. Other events. 3 events would happen this year that don't have specific dates. The first was the founding of the Toronto Star by Horatio Clarence Hawken. First printed on the presses of Toronto World, which owned 51% of the newspaper, the paper did poorly in its first years, but would slowly see its influence grow, and today it is still around and enjoys a circulation of 193,000 people on weekdays and 290,000 on Saturdays. It currently ranks 2nd to the Globe and Mail for circulation in Canada. Harbard Collegiate Institute would be founded this year as well. The school exists to this day, and from the 1920s to 1950s, it had a 90% Jewish student population. Today, the population consists largely of students of East Asian and Portuguese descent. Several well-known Canadians have come from the school, including Charles Best, the co-discoverer of insulin, filmmaker David Cronenberg, Jack Cole, the founder of Cole's Bookstores, comedian Howie Mandel, Johnny Wayne and Frank Schuster of Wayne & Schuster, Morley Safer, and Philip Givens, a former mayor of Toronto. Humberside Collegiate Institute was also founded this year, and also exists to this day. Established in 1892 as the Toronto Junction High School in a church basement, it would move to its current site in High Park in 1894. The school has several notable alumni, including comedian Samantha Bee, boxer George Shivalo, who I did an episode on a few months ago, Olympian Abby Hoffman, and a former hockey player named J.P. Anderson. This year also saw the first documented women's ice hockey game, which took place in Barrie, Ontario, on an outdoor rink. Other tidbits. On September 29th, the United States government filed a complaint against the Canadian Pacific Railway Company, alleging that they were transporting Chinese individuals from China into the United States. The CPR denied the allegations, stating in the reply that the allegations and suggestions of the present note of the Honorable the Secretary of State of the United States are not borne out by the facts, and that if his information as to the numbers of Chinese would find access to the United States through Canada and of those who are awaiting transport thither of Vancouver is correct, which seems doubtful. In a letter from W.C. Van Horn of the CPR to the Right Honorable John Haggart, he states, "It is evident that someone has been making outrageous misrepresentations at Washington on the subject. There is no congregation of Chinese at Vancouver, or anywhere about our Pacific terminus, waiting to go into the United States. Nor has there been at any time, nor have we sold tickets to any Chinese who lack the proper certificates to secure their return to the United States." I hope you enjoyed that look at 1892, and if you did, please give a rating and review. It helps the podcast a lot. You can reach me at craig@canadaehx.com. You can visit my website where you'll find hundreds of articles on Canada's history, as well as all my podcast episodes. Go to CanadaEHX.com. And if you really want to help, you can support the podcast by going to Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/CanadaEHX. And thank you to all of my wonderful patrons, including Phil Maynard, Robert Dunseith, Todd Casey, Catherine Rawa, Luke S., Fick Hedges, J.P. Bear, Jason Hall, Spencer M., Renee Bellevaux, and Iris Gray. I appreciate the support you guys give. Thanks, and we'll see you again next time.